You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
The Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, thank you so much for coming today. This panel, we've been really excited about this particular issue for many, many years since the E911 Act was passed in Congress. The Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee held its first congressional briefing on location privacy in like 2001. But it was just a bit ahead of its time. The congressional staff were kind of shrugging their shoulders, and because nobody had GPS tracking phones, and it was a bit, you know, it's like surfing. You don't want to be too far ahead of the wave that you don't get the wave. So it was a little bit too ahead of its time. But right now, this issue has become very, very, very timely. The idea for the panel was looking at the Jones case, which is a Supreme Court case that was argued several months ago, where the justices heard a case about the law enforcement using GPS tracking to kind of find the whereabouts of a particular individual, a suspect. And the court heard all oral arguments, and they will this summer, June or July, will decide the extent to which geolocation information is, you know, GPS tracking is a violation of the Fourth Amendment or not, and that'll be an interesting case. We really don't expect, the justices to really make really profound statements beyond whether this guy is, they're going to find him guilty or not based on the scope of the tracking. But it raises a whole host of possibilities that Professor Rosen and Andrew had kind of articulated in a recent NPR article, and we wanted to kind of explore that. What is the reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to things like the technology, when it comes to geolocation or facial recognition, technologies that could never have been contemplated by, you know, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin back in the day. And in our Fourth Amendment construct doesn't really have any way to kind of decide that. Is it just one-time geolocation, or is it like continuous, pervasive, longitudinal tracking? And how does the Constitution and our Fourth Amendment privacy respond to these new technologies? The Federal Trade Commission is did a workshop and is looking at facial recognition technology. Obviously, GPS and geolocation. Probably everybody in this room is somehow transmitting their geolocation at this very moment. Whether or not anyone's there to receive it or not, but it's pervasive, and we wanted to put together a panel of smart folks to look at what is your reasonable expectation of privacy in the constitutional sense, but also how does your use of these technologies and your expectation of how the government will use these technologies affect your Fourth Amendment rights and right to privacy, so to speak. So we'll go a few minutes for each panelist and go down the line. I'll introduce each one at first, and then we'll just ask him for a few comments. To my far left, we have Professor Jeff Rosen, who is the author of Constitution 3.0, which is a really interesting book, and it was the subject of that NPR article that I would refer you to. He's a professor at George Washington University, and he's the legal affairs editor at the New Republic. Next to him is Andrew McLaughlin, who has left Washington, D.C. for New York.
Woo!
and it's not easy to get him back, so we're thrilled. Andrew is vice president for Tumblr now. Just before that post, he was the deputy chief technology officer for the White House. I'm sure you're glad I didn't have to work over the weekend on SOPA in that capacity. Before that, Andrew was a vice president at Google, and even I first met you when you were working for ICANN way back in the day. And then we have, to my right, we have Kashmir Hill, who I'm a big fan of. He's a writer for Forbes and a self-described privacy pragmatist. And maybe she can explain what that is. And before Forbes, she was the editor of the blog Above the Law. And to my far right is a regular here at State of the Net, Stuart Baker, who's with partner at Steptoe & Johnson. But before that was with the Department of Homeland Security as an assistant secretary. And he is the author of a book called Skating on Stilts. So I think the order I was planning on doing this was Jeff, Stuart, then Andrew, then Kashmir, and then doing some Q&A. I think I'm really interested in one question that Stuart raised in I think it was a New York Times article, was your reasonable expectation, which is kind of a term of art of how we see our Fourth Amendment rights and our constitutional privacy rights as kind of influenced perhaps by our use of technology, and our understanding that how government will use it. So, for instance, is it unreasonable to expect that J. Edgar Hoover will, you know, clip files about you when a woman on Match.com who has a blind date tonight with a few keystrokes can compile a dossier very similar to what J. Edgar Hoover was able to do back in the day? So our commercial uses of those technologies and what we expect government to do kind of eroding, perhaps, our constitutional rights. So let me start with Professor Rosen.
Can we read some bad feedback? I don't know.
I'm sorry, really?
Push it back further.
Yeah, do something. You're usually easy to listen to. That was pretty painful.
Is it the microphone? Or
yeah,
how do you
I
guys,
think, I think the
how do you guys on the job back there?
The mic is too sensitive, that's my guess.
I mean, if it's the substance, I apologize. But if it's the microphone...
It's a little early to be revolting, Mike.
I know. Was it that bad?
God.
All right, Professor Rosen.
Excellent. So, welcome. Thank you so much for coming. And I'm very much looking forward to talking about this fascinating subject. The question we've been asked is there any reasonable expectation of privacy in public? Now, two lower federal courts and the Obama administration have said no. We have no reasonable expectation of privacy on public streets because it's theoretically possible for our neighbors or for the police to put a tail on us and to follow us. Therefore, the police can use virtual technologies like GPS devices to achieve the same surveillance 24/7 for a month. However, and of course I'm just going to describe this neutrally, but I would say in a visionary decision on the other side, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit has disagreed. And Judge Douglas Ginsburg said, of course there's a difference between your neighbor tracking you for a few blocks and the police tracking you 24/7 for a month. 24/7 ubiquitous surveillance can reveal so much more about us. The magazines we read, the people we associate with, our patterns and preferences, that we do, said Judge Ginsburg, have an expectation of privacy in the whole of our data, and the police should require a warrant before tracking a criminal suspect 24/7 for a month. What will the Supreme Court do? I don't know, of course. I was heartened by the skepticism of these technologies that justices on both sides of the political spectrum took in the oral argument when Chief Justice John Roberts asked the Obama administration's lawyer, is it the government's position that the police could put a GPS device on the bottom of the cars of the members of this court and track us 24/7? And the government lawyer said, yes, I hope that that was the moment that he may have lost the case. But I would put to you, my sense is that two of us, Andrew and I, are going to be a little bit more on the side of the yes, there is an expectation of privacy. Our colleagues may be a bit more skeptical. If I were to take a vote and ask whether you think there's no expectation of privacy in public, I would like to put the following hypothetical on the table before we do that. I was at a conference at Google in 2007 when Andrew was the head of public policy, and Andrew asked the most prescient, forward-looking technology question that I've heard in years. He said that he expected that within the next few years, Google would be asked to put live and online all public and private surveillance cameras in the world. There are already isolated apps like this. Facebook has an app you can sign in and watch live beach cams in Mexico, which are popular with teenage boys for reasons that you can imagine. So under Andrew's prediction, not his hypothetical, Google and Facebook and companies like it would be asked to link and store and archive and put online all surveillance cameras. If this were done and the cameras were linked and the coverage were ubiquitous, it would be possible to click on a picture of me, back-click on to see where I'd come from this morning, forward-click to see where I'm going this afternoon, and basically have 24 surveillance of everyone in the world at all time. We can well imagine, perhaps not Google, but maybe Facebook might want to introduce this as a cool new app. Mark Zuckerberg might call it Open Planet or something like this and think that it would be really useful to track your friends and stay up to date on them. I put to you this question, would we have an expectation of privacy against Open Planet if the FBI used the system to track me without any suspicion 24/7 for a month? Show of hands, just out of curiosity, who thinks that this 24/7 Open Planet surveillance system would be an unreasonable search and seizure if used by the FBI and therefore would violate the Fourth Amendment? And who disagrees? All right, it may be a libertarian crowd, but when you push it that way, I think most people gasp when they think about that sort of ubiquitous surveillance and want to impose limits on it. And therefore, I think that we on this side of the table have the easy case to make. Yes, there's some expectation of privacy in public, some forms of surveillance that would be patently unreasonable, even if they take place outside the home. Drawing the line is hard. Where will the Supreme Court draw the line? I don't know. Where should it draw the line? It might draw it very narrowly in this case. At the oral argument, Justices Scalia and Kennedy focused on the fact that the government had committed a physical trespass when it installed the GPS device on the bottom of the car without a warrant. It was therefore an unreasonable seizure. The court might just say, when you're going to physically put a GPS device on the bottom of a car, you need a warrant. Of course, that would be a Pyrrhic victory. It would soon be overtaken by technology in an age when very soon, in the next year or two, cars are going to have hardwired GPS devices. You don't need to install the physical device. As Judge Alec Kaczynski noted in an absolutely path-breaking dissenting opinion on the Ninth Circuit, he said, unless we put a stop to this in this case, the government will be able to do what it's already trying to do, namely seize geolocational devices from cell phones without any cause at all. Kaczynski said, I was born in Bucharest. My parents were Holocaust survivors. They couldn't have imagined this degree of surveillance. George Orwell has arrived. Perhaps the court then will rule more narrowly, more broadly. It might say it's okay to put a tail on someone for 100 miles and to use a beeper to enhance the physical search, as the court upheld in the Knotts case. In other words, if the cops are going to physically follow you, they can use a GPS or a beeper to keep track of you. But once they're going to engage purely in virtual surveillance without physically tailing you, then they do need a warrant. That would be a broader ruling. Or they could come up with something in between. You can follow someone for a day, but not for a month. What the court will do, I don't know. What it should do, I am confident of, and that is impose some limits on this technology. And the last thing I'll say to set this up is that we shouldn't rely just on the courts to settle the question of expectation of privacy in public. There's a bill pending in Congress, a Geolocational Privacy Act, co-sponsored by Representative Chaffetz, the Utah Republican, and Senator Wyden, the Oregon Democrat, which would require consent before geolocational data is disclosed. Also, Europe is going to take a very active role in this debate. The European Privacy Commissioner, Viviane Reding, has proposed a right to oblivion, or a right to be forgotten, which is very French, of course. Americans want to be remembered. The French want to be forgotten. And the idea is that if someone takes a picture of you outside a bar and uses Facebook's face recognition technology to identify you by name and post that on their webpage, in Europe, that might already be in a violation of existing data privacy laws, but would certainly be a violation of this new right to oblivion and would require the data subject to have the option of demanding that the picture be taken down. So let's not imagine for a moment that the Supreme Court will have the last word on this matter, but I hope that it will protect privacy in public, remembering the words of my hero, Louis Brandeis, who understood the need of translating the Constitution in light of new technologies. Brandeis said, if we would guide by the light of reason, we must let our minds be bold. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Stuart?
Okay, thanks. I was given 3 minutes to talk about this, and I tried to figure out what I could do in 3 minutes that would be most useful. And so let me start with a soundtrack. Raise your hands if you recognize this. Great. Okay, so now I can stop playing it. I played that because that was Poker Face, for those of you who missed it.
It was under 5 seconds, and it was fair use.
It was well, we'll see. Prediction, you'll get taken down off of YouTube. But that's why soap is such a bad idea. The reason I played that is because it's, if you remember that, that was the soundtrack for the debate over the stimulus and maybe the health care bill. The best video was produced by U.S. troops in Iraq. You know, it's already starting to feel a little nostalgic, a little dated. It's in our rearview mirror now. That is exactly how this debate will seem in a few years. It is a precise moment in time. 20, 30 years ago, when the Supreme Court looked at this issue, they were given a beeper that was attached to somebody's bumper, and the police used the beeper to figure out where the guy was and to follow him. And they said, yeah, well, he's in public. What do you expect? No problem. And in 10 years, all of us will have integrated geolocation data so deeply into our lives that we will see all of the advantages of it. We will have learned to live with, discount, and avoid many of the disadvantages that come with it. And we'll be astonished that somebody would think we should live without geolocation capabilities. And when we're in that world, the idea that there are some special limits on the government using data that we use all the time, just as though, you know, it was like saying the FBI, which is in fact the case prior to 9/11, the FBI was the only entity in the country that could not print out its Google searches on people because it was illegal for them to do it, and because we had seen the future coming, and by God, we weren't going to go there. And so we imposed those limits on the FBI. It was nuts. This will be nuts. It'll look nuts if we do it. There'll be nothing but unintended consequences, and most of them will be bad.
That was 3 minutes, definitely. Andrew.
So let me make 2 points. What I'm looking for in this decision, what I hope the Supreme Court will do at the constitutional level, is basically resurrect and reiterate the principle that differences in degree can become differences in kind. And this is one of the most important principles in privacy and data protection kind of generally. So the background to this case is that there was a decision called Knotts, U.S. against Knotts, in which the Supreme Court said that it was perfectly okay under the Constitution for the police to stick a radio tracker on a barrel of contraband, which then went into a car, drove to a destination, and revealed the physical location of the person moving the contraband. And the court focused on the fact that it was the car was moving in public and that this was tracking a discrete trip. And then it reserved the question of whether or not what they called kind of dragnet surveillance, but in other words, ubiquitous 24/7 kinds of surveillance would violate the Fourth Amendment. And it's that principle that something which done discreetly can be perfectly permissible because the expectation of privacy is that it is in fact discreet, can become a constitutional violation when you multiply it out by many, many millions of data points, is to me what's kind of at the heart of this decision. And I'm hoping that the Supreme Court will grapple with that. One of the frustrating things I thought about the oral argument was the kind of back and forth of slippery slope problems that were posed. In other words, it's very difficult to try to figure out a principled basis if you allow any law enforcement agency to stick a tracking device underneath a car. It's hard to find a principled point at which you can stop that from becoming ubiquitous 24/7 surveillance based on something as vague as a suspicion. On the flip side, the court, grappling with a slippery slope problem that, well, if we find that this is a Fourth Amendment violation, we're going to have to get a warrant every time we want to do physical surveillance of somebody, because after all, just having agents out on the street following people is something that they do. And what I see as a way to sort of through that is to take the Supreme Court at its word and in the Knotts decision, and to say, well, some things multiplied out by many times are just different in kind from the discrete thing. And so, for example, in this case, the D.C. Circuit's test was to say, is law enforcement through this device getting access to data which is not in any meaningful sense public? In other words, sure, the car may be in public all the time, but there is no single individual that will know all of the tracking and all of the patterns that are revealed by multiple pings to a geolocator every minute. And it's that aggregation of data which is not in any meaningful sense public that's being revealed and therefore qualifies this as a search and therefore triggers the reasonableness requirement under the Fourth Amendment. So that's point number one. Differences in degree can become differences in kind, and I hope the Supreme Court will acknowledge that under the Fourth Amendment. More importantly, though, what this case, I think, raises and what the, as Stuart rightly points out, what the proliferation of geolocation technologies is going to require us to grapple with is that the Constitution is not really our best bulwark of protection here. I really do believe that statute is required, that the law is going to be required in order to keep up. Our IRS, Internal Revenue Code like categorical delineations of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence are simply not adequate to the task, I think, of keeping up with these technologies, and as a result, we're going to need some kind of statutory response to protect Americans' rights. And let me just say one last thing, which is echoing what Stuart just said on the other side of the debate. I really do think that for the United States to realize the benefits that massive data sets across millions of individuals, whether it's geolocational, whether it's healthcare data, whether it's remote sensed data about environmental conditions or traffic patterns or whatever, for us to realize those benefits, we really do have to come up with a better baseline set of privacy protections than we have right now. For example, it would be a catastrophe for this country if we passed legislation which unintendedly made it extremely difficult for research scientists and even individual practicing physicians to be able to run queries across millions of data points, millions of patients, to reveal for me, statistically speaking, with my condition and my attributes, what is the best outcome I can hope for and how do I get there? If we can run analysis against millions of prior patients and understand for somebody of my sex, race, gender, medical history, and condition, of the five drugs which might be recommended, this one is likely to give me the best result, that would be something very valuable to society and requires that we have the right sort of statutory protections against, for example, private abuse. Because after all, we're not going to get rid of the state action doctrine anytime soon. The Fourth Amendment isn't going to help us there. We really need to set those kinds of baselines. Those are my 2 points.
So Kashmir is a privacy pragmatist.
Do you want me to explain what that means? I think I'm on the panel as the with Stuart, the proponent of publicness, which is something that Jeff Jarvis likes to call it. I mean, I call myself a pragmatist because I like to think about privacy in terms of all the benefits that are gained from having a lot of information out there about ourselves. And it just seems that it's something that consumers are embracing. They really like having dossiers on Facebook and broadcasting their location to friends on Foursquare or Find Your Friends on the iPhone. So part of what I do at Forbes on the page that I call the Not So Private Parts is charting kind of the upsides and occasional downsides of being very public. Covering the Jones case, it almost it seems dated already to think about the police needing to put trackers on cars. As Jeff was saying, now that we increasingly we're in this web of things where everything is connected, you don't necessarily need to add the trackers. They're already there. Oftentimes when I'm looking at these privacy debates, I'm wondering if we're going to look back at them and they're going to seem as dated as the debate over caller ID in the 1990s when people felt that it was a violation of their privacy to have, when they called somebody, their identity attached to that number. Even looking back at Brandeis's first kind of legal definition of privacy, and the idea that he was offended by people taking photos of anybody and then putting them in the newspaper, that seemed a violation of privacy then. They called them Kodak fiends. I just think that we're in a period of flux, and we're still getting used to how privacy is changing. We're going to be in a very different world in 10 years. Just because I'm a proponent of publicness doesn't mean that I'm a proponent of a surveillance society. But I think that what we reasonably expect to be private is changing all the time. And I hate to see certain technologies held back because we are so adamant about how we are currently defining privacy.
So if our expectations of what is reasonably private are changing, does that mean that there should be no limits on the Fourth Amendment ability for law enforcement kind of track us and also track our facial biometric as we move across in public spaces? I think we know what Stuart feels about this.
It's hard for me to imagine a time when there will be no limits whatsoever on tracking. I mean, there's still we all carry around our cell phones, and we are tracked. And I am not in favor of getting rid of the requirement to get a court order in order to look at your historical location or even figure out where you are right now so that you can be arrested. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be completely over on the other side.
No, you're pragmatist, I know.
But I am pragmatic as opposed to just anti-privacy.
So, Professor Rosen, they have a fair point. Three years ago, we had Dr. Laura Craner and somebody else on this very similar panel talking about the actual technology of location tracking. And one of the fellows up there was saying, listen, if you were to tell me, 5 years ago that I'd be tweeting everything I'm doing on a given day, on a daily basis, or I'm checking in with Foursquare, or if I'm posting all my photos on Facebook, I would have told you you're crazy. It had a creepiness factor. But I think what Kashmir and Stuart are saying, that creepiness kind of just falls away when you find a service that you really like. And isn't there kind of we're just getting used to these technologies. It doesn't mean it's creepiness is actually necessarily bad.
I don't think it's a fair, convincing point at all to say that our expectation of privacy are changing and 5 years what we want to expose is different than it is now. Of course that's the case. But that in no way answers this basic question of whether there should be no limits whatsoever. And I think it's striking that most people in this room, with a handful of exceptions, and everyone on this panel, with the exception of Stuart, rejects the radical and unconvincing position of the Obama administration that there's no expectation of privacy in public. That doesn't coincide with what people actually expect now. It doesn't coincide with human needs of privacy throughout history. And it's not going to be the case that in 5 years with more geolocational devices, people just throw in the towel and say, fine, let the government track us 24/7. So what's so interesting about this case is just the extremism with which, and I should say unnecessary extremism with which the government is arguing this case. You know that the cops did get a warrant to track the suspected drug dealer. It was invalid because they were supposed to serve it within 10 days. They did it with 11 days. They were supposed to do it within D.C. Instead, they tracked the guy in Maryland. So to say in this case the government needed a warrant would just be to require them to get correctly what they would have gotten anyway. And that reinforces the fact that in no way is this technological progress going to be trampled, and are we going to be denied the benefits of these wonderful technologies if the court requires a warrant for the most extreme and ubiquitous surveillance. The reason that I think that we have, and if the debate is posed as it's been now, I think that we have an easier time than Stuart. And therefore, I'll throw it back to him, Stuart. Why the court in every case since the Katz case in the 1960s has dodged this question of what the expectation of privacy are. Why do you unnecessarily take the position that there's none at all and that there's no form of public surveillance that could possibly violate the Fourth Amendment?
It is common for people, especially people who are technologically sophisticated, to say we need principles that are not tied to a single technology. And I think, broadly speaking, that's right, because if you tie it to a particular technology, it's going to fall out of date fairly rapidly. And yet in this case, I don't think it's extreme at all to say, there's a couple of principles that are pretty obvious and that we've always taken the view that public is public. If you give data to somebody else, then it's his secret too. He can do with it as he chooses. These are basic principles that you can apply as people's concept of privacy evolves. If they don't think it's if they think it's something to be ashamed of, they won't do it in public by and large. If they think it's an important secret, they won't give it to third parties by and large. And so you can actually measure changing notions of what's a reasonable expectation of privacy based on whether people do things in public and whether they hand data about those activities to third parties. Those are simple principles that have been applied by the court for 30 years. And to come in and say, no, this time we really should distinguish between a month and a day of that. That's the crucial distinction. Or the crucial distinction is whether you are physically following them or virtually following. And maybe, okay, you could be virtually following and physically following. That would be okay, but not just completely virtually, at least not with this kind of technology, although the next question is going to be, what about license plate readers? What about going to Foursquare? I think the people who are on your side of this are the people who are trying to open up a nightmare of litigation and hand these technology issues to judges who really are not competent. Let me read you a question. This left me dumbstruck from the argument. This is Justice Kagan, the youngest justice on the court, who says to the government, I mean, if you think about this, this is just too much. Think about a little robotic device following you around 24 hours a day, any place you go, not your home, reporting all your movements. I'm just not sure if we do go there. You want to say, Madam Justice Kagan, have you met this little robotic device named Stuart, Android?
But Stuart, it seems to me that you're steamrolling over one really critical distinction, which is that you are choosing to use that phone. You have chosen which apps to put on it. You have selected which services to use, given whatever your level of understanding about the terms and conditions of the use of that data are going to be. There's a very big difference between the government sicking a technology on you that you have not chosen.
License plate readers, which are going to be ubiquitous too, because they're dirt cheap and the resolution is going to be good enough. You can follow people around using license plate readers that are going to be publicly available, certainly available to the cops. So yeah, are we now supposed to say, oh, well, that'll be okay because they're not actually attaching something to your car, but if they attach something to the car, that'd be just terrible.
Here's a way the D.C. Circuit, it seems to me that Judge Ginsburg lights a path out of this conundrum. So first of all, millions of Americans voluntarily choosing to check in to Foursquare occasionally and to tweet occasionally. By the way, I don't know anybody who tweets everything they're doing or checks into every place they're going. They're still making choices about which things they want to reveal and to whom.
Absolutely.
And to whom, right? I use Google Latitude, which tracks my physical location all the time, but I restrict that to about 8 people, including my wife, by the way. So it seems to me that let's take the license plate reader, for example. It's absolutely predictable, and therefore my reasonable expectation, that my license plate will be noted as I take a discrete journey from one place to another or go into one parking ramp or another. It would be surprising to me if it were being tracked everywhere I went and made accessible to the government in a way that I had not chosen to establish my patterns of behavior across many different journeys. And so the difference between a day and a month is really the difference between a single thing that you would expect an individual to notice out on the street, and even a discrete journey across state lines might be a stretch of that. But let's suppose that somebody could follow me, but tracking me for 28 days in a row really is different. And yes, it's annoying and frustrating and potentially opens some litigation to try to figure out what the line is in between those two things. But we've gone through this many times before. We've had cases about are thermal sensors of the home permissible? What about the curtilage around the home? Yes, we have a strong expectation of privacy inside the home, but what about the 3 feet zone outside the window where you can look in? Is that covered? And we've gone through this sort of thing before. For Fourth Amendment purposes, I think we have no choice but to try to establish some of those principles, because it is simply the case that expectations of massive data collection across many multiple days and many different locations, unwillingly, over and above, without any sort of consent of the individual, really is different from a snapshot of a license plate that you might grab at a parking garage.
But are you really saying that Fourth Amendment expectations depend on the cluelessness of the public, that they don't understand that there's a back end in these cameras?
The notion of reasonableness is the idea in public, when we're talking about presence in public spaces, it seems to me that the notion of reasonableness is the expectation about what can be learned from my presence in public. What can be learned from my presence in public today is what I'm wearing, what I'm saying, who I'm sitting next to, and who I'm talking with, those sorts of things. What I would not expect to be learnable about me is how often I come to this hotel, and which rooms exactly I go into on which days of the week, and so forth. It's that pattern behavior that, to me, takes a difference in degree and turns it into a difference in kind for constitutional purposes as to the reasonableness of my expectation of privacy. In other words, just like we say that, for example, an IP address alone is not personally identifiable information, but many IP addresses over time combined with account information equals personally identifiable information. There we take things which in their discrete and individual packets would isolated packets would not be considered a privacy violation or to implicate privacy. But when assembled into these large groupings over time, does implicate my privacy. It's the same principle to me.
There's another thing.
Well, let's have Kashmir was about to say something.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's already too late to put the limits on the actual collection of data, the actual tracking. You know, it's already happening. There are surveillance.
By the government or by whom?
Well, there are surveillance cameras everywhere. You know, with the Lower Manhattan Security Initiative in New York, you have license plate scanning already. And that's where you live. So this is already happening. That data is being collected. I think where you want to think about the limits is in the mining of that data. This is something the Department of Homeland Security is already thinking about because they are basically fusing all of their information across different agencies. And the question is, when are you allowed to go into that data to target a particular license plate or to target a particular person?
Or does the government need a warrant in order to get into that database and get it out?
Right.
I have to say that one of the things that's – I'm sorry.
You could say that linkage is a form of impermissible use, and it's okay to collect it and just watch it discreetly, but once it's linked, it becomes unreasonable. But there's another thing I want to say is there's a constitutional history here. And Stuart is saying cavalierly that, well, we just assume that if we share it with someone else that we abandon all expectation of privacy in it for all purposes. That would guarantee less privacy in the age of the iPhone than the framers took for granted. So the paradigmatic example of an unreasonable search at the time of the framing was breaking into the home of a critic of the king to figure out who wrote anonymous pamphlets criticizing the king, riffling through a lot of people's desk drawers and then identifying John Wilkes as the offender. If we were to say now that the government, without breaking into the home, can riffle through far more intimate papers than the king's agents ever had access to with physical trespass, then we would have less privacy today than the framers took for granted. Justice Scalia in the thermal imaging case said, for someone who cares about original understanding, you can't interpret the Fourth Amendment so people have less privacy today than they did back then. That might well mean that Stewart's claim that the third-party doctrine, namely whenever I share information with Google, Google's entitled to share it with the government, needs to be reexamined, and there might even be Fourth Amendment limitations on the idea of sharing in cloud computing. But we have to just keep in mind what the framers were trying to protect, and it's obvious that we'd have far less protection for today if we accepted Stewart's position.
Well, let me. This may be a silly question, but let me talk about public spaces and what is the harm? What harms are we trying to get at here? And are they? Do we really care that much? If you're in plain sight and you're doing something wrong, that the police catch you doing that, and is that a problem?
Yeah, I do think that there is a tendency to debate these things in the abstract and for everybody to say, do I want the police to know this about me? And somehow we all imagine that we're back in high school. In fact, you have to ask yourself, do we really want the police to be prevented from investigating and catching people who are trying to kill us by using these techniques? Remember the snipers in a world that Jeff Rosen wants to live in. All the rest of us could go online and start looking at all these surveillance cameras, correlating all the data about which cars were in the neighborhood. Cops, though, no, they got to have probable cause. They got to have a suspect. This is nuts. Once it's possible to do it, we will expect the people who are paid to protect us to do it. And the idea that we will be worried about our privacy in the face of that kind of a terror campaign, I think is bizarre.
Although, isn't it all we're saying, though, is that there needs to be a warrant? And by the way, there's a doctrine of exigent circumstances that allows the police to go warrantlessly if there's an emergency situation.
So who's do you have individualized suspicion and probable cause about any one of those cars? I don't think so. I mean, this is a pain in the butt. You're not going to be able to do it fast. You're going to have lots of legal questions. Maybe in the end you'll get over them. But everybody else is doing it like this. It makes no sense.
Yeah, but there is a difference between the state and everybody else, right? I mean, the state has a monopoly of force and has the ability to put me in jail. Google does not, and so that's part of the reason why we have these protections.
I understand the theory that says, oh, well, we should be more worried about the government. But the fact is, for most of us, most of the bad things that will happen because our location data is available widely are not going to come from the government. They're going to come from somebody else that is close to us or doesn't like us or something of the sort. And we will learn to live with all of those consequences. And then the idea that the police can't use this data to keep us safe is going to look nutty. And I have to say, if you just listen to what Jeff has said, talk about extremism. Not only does he want to overturn rules about public is public, he wants to say, oh, and we have to get rid of the rule that says that when you give data to other people or property to other people, they have something to say about whether to give it to the police. That rule's got to go. Big data, oh, linkage is unconstitutional too. So you can't use big data if you're the government. You can't even link up your own data from your own databases, because that requires a constitutional exercise of judicial oversight. We're living in a world run by judges who are only going to get in the way of doing jobs that really need to be done. And I say this because I spent a lot of time focusing on what happened before 9/11, when judges were running the FBI's wall between intelligence and law enforcement, and when they contributed quite dramatically and quite directly to our inability to catch the hijackers. And we have suffered deep harm from plausible-sounding privacy doctrines along the lines of, let's have some limitations on the use of this information.
Well, I have one quick question for Andrew, then one for Kashmir, but I also want to go out and get audience questions.
Can I just respond to that?
Sure.
Which completely misrepresented my position. I said nothing of the kind. I never said that every linkage should be struck down by judges. I never said that the entire third-party doctrine violated the Fourth Amendment. I said that these linkage and the sharing of third-party data might raise constitutional issues, and that they need to be regulated as Europe has regulated them. Each of the things that Stuart mentioned has been regulated in Europe by statute. Europe does not embrace the idea that data shared for one purpose can be shared for another. Linkage is regulated in Europe, and it's also the case that his nightmare scenario of the cops not being able to stop a sniper could clearly be dealt with under exigent circumstances exceptions. So all of these points are red herring, and he remains against a corner of taking this radical position that we have no expectation of privacy in public. You asked what the harm was, and no one has answered yet. So I'll tell you what the harm is. Uncertainty about whether you're being observed. A sense that you may or may not be being spied on in public without your consent is the quintessential violation of autonomy. From Bentham's Panopticon up, people have behaved in a less spontaneous, less creative, less free way when they think they're being spied on without their consent, and that's why autonomy is implicated, and it's a very grave harm.
Well, let me build on that and ask Kashmir, with regard to harm, like the mother of this organization, the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory, a woman named Judith Krug, who founded the Office of Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association. She founded Banned Books Week. And she had this view of privacy that if you weren't able to read what you want to read without some type of surveillance, it really chilled your intellectual curiosity in many ways that are just really hard to quantify. Now, you spend a lot of time looking at what people expose in not-so-private parts. And do you feel like if there were pervasive government surveillance about location, facial recognition, things like that were in the public space, do you think it would have like some kind of profound effect on the populace?
Yeah, there's this question of whether being exposed and being able to see what everyone is doing will make our society more repressed because everyone is conforming, or whether when you see what everyone else does, we become more accepting of people's kind of strange habits. And my sense is that, and I kind of hope for the latter, that, you know, when I'm looking around on Facebook and all these other places where I gather information for stories, it seems like people are not all that repressed. And that has led to some negative consequences for some people early on, because I think we are early on in this, where, you know, someone's drinking photos results in their losing their job. But I think that's just because we're not fully evolved here yet, and that there's going to be a time when we all have drinking photos, and it doesn't surprise you. Yeah, my sense is that as a society we're evolving to embrace publicness, get the benefits of putting a lot of information out there, and that so far it doesn't seem to be leading to a more a kind of chilled society, which is part of the reason why I'm usually in support of these various kinds of publicness and tracking.
So let me open up for questions. I assume
we have some. You have any questions? Sure, I'm Tim Lee with Ars Technica, and I have a question for Stuart. So we've been talking a lot about the third-party doctrine, and the sort of prototypical case is a case where there's some, you know, you deliberately hand over some piece of information to some company or something. But it seems like a lot of the cases we're talking about, especially with cell phone tracking, this is a case where maybe the user is aware that, say, the cell phone location is being tracked, maybe they're not, but certainly they're not. They're not giving the information because they want their cell phone company to have it. They're giving the information because it's a technical necessity in order to have the cell phone service. And I wonder if that matters, where the sort of the logic of the third-party doctrine kind of breaks down when people are turning over information because they have no choice, rather than because they and may not even be thinking about that fact, rather than a case where they're, you know, it's a conscious decision to give information that they know they're handing over.
Yeah, I think that's whacked.
Is that good or bad? I can never remember.
To say, we all know that we're not going to get phone calls if the phone company can't find us. It has to know where we are. Our phone has to check in and say, if you've got a call to make to this guy, he's in this quadrant of this cell tower. This is the same argument. Well, the lack of clue that the American public has should somehow give them greater rights. I don't think that makes any sense. You do have a choice. You don't need a cell phone. You can use a landline. The landline doesn't require the same certainty about where you are at any particular time. And to say, I really want all the benefits of this technology, but I don't want to take the rest of the stuff that is an inherent part of the technology, strikes me as the weirdly anti-technology.
I just got to say, saying that law enforcement has to go get a warrant, period, does not strike me as anti-technology. In other words, it's so non-burdensome. I mean, as you know, there's like paperwork to be filled out, but it's not like it's particularly painful to go and get a judge. But the interposition of that third party looking over the shoulder of law enforcement is so important to the sort of restraints on abuse that we have.
Andrew, have you ever worked for a company that didn't value big data and the ability to say, if we have enough data, we can make sense out of it, we can find patterns that no one else would find.
Company.
You can't do that with a warrant because you have to have a suspect and you have to have probable cause. You can't just say, let's go see what the data tells us.
Well, that's what they did in this case. They had some cause but not enough to arrest him, and they got the warrant and they followed him and found that they were right. What's the problem?
They had him.
So like I said before, like take national security, public safety, healthcare, environmental protection. I can think of many different areas where the collection, assemblage, linkage, and analysis of vast data sets that, if not handled properly, can be personally identifying, will deliver great benefits to society. I totally get that, and I want to enable that. One of the things that I worry, though, is that without the right kinds of protections, we're going to screw this whole thing up because the natural allergy that Americans have to the government looking over my shoulder and seeing what I'm doing, whether it's the canonical gay 17-year-old teenager in rural Wyoming trying to figure out what his identity is and who his community are, or the reader in New York City. I was just telling Jeff I read Lolita over the past week. And in previous decades, I definitely would have not wanted people knowing that I read Lolita, right, at a time when it could have been confiscated for obscenity or something like that. There are all kinds of things that people don't want the government to know about. And what I don't want to do is see privacy either kill off big data analysis or a complete lack of privacy kill off people's willingness to let their data be analyzed in ways that are socially useful.
I'm deeply skeptical of the idea that Tim, go ahead.
We have another question.
So it's Mark McCarthy from Georgetown University and SIIA. Great discussion, of course. The exercise in line drawing, Andy, that you sort of started off one day is
Andrew.
Okay. but you know we can't allow it for a month. That raises the question that maybe if you go back to the way the third-party doctrine evolved in financial services, you might want to think about another way to approach this rather than leaving it in the hands of judges to draw these kind of lines. Why don't we move to a statutory framework which tries to take these issues into account and pass a piece of legislation that provides not constitutional protections but statutory protections?
Statutory protections would be great. And if the judges don't act, then we're very likely to get a statute. Remember what happened in the financial services cases. So the Supreme Court, in cases like Miller and Smith, says when you surrender your data to the bank is entitled to turn it over to the government. And Congress rebelled because that did not at all coincide with people's expectations. No one expected that when they shared private financial information with their bank, it could be shared widely for all purposes, and then it passed a Financial Privacy Act that restricted that kind of data gathering. So that very fact rebukes Stewart's repeated claim that people have to expect that when they share for one purposes, they share for all purposes. Another rebuke to that is the Central European Data Privacy Law, which says the opposite. It says when you share data for one purpose, it may not be shared for another without the consent of the individual concerned. Now, ideally, we would have a version of that data privacy law here. It's tough to pass in practice because the same libertarian conservatives who are suspicious of surveillance by the government don't want to regulate the private sector because of free market concerns. So it's hard to get the votes for that reason. And that's why a combination of judicial action and statutory action may be helpful. But there's just no doubt that the radical position that every time you share for one purpose, you abandon all expectation of privacy for all purposes is completely unconvincing, and most of the world has rejected it.
The idea that I will feel rebuked because the French disagree with me is very slim.
Well, Congress disagreed with you, too. Congress disagreed with you.
Let me explain why I have this allergy to tinkering with, just a little bit more. Instead of a subpoena, they'd get a warrant. How bad could it be? This is part of a pattern of privacy advocacy that goes back to the first article that Justice Brandeis wrote about privacy, in which he bitched and moaned that people knew the menu at his private gatherings and that they could take his picture without his permission. And he actually said, well, as I think Jeff has said, we'll let the judges sort this out, we'll give them a little authority over this, you know, we should have a right in our image, which shouldn't be just taken without our leave. And there were statutes passed that would give people a right of privacy in their image. It turned out to be a nightmare, and it served only the interest of the powerful and the wealthy, people who could afford to say, this is my image. Lady Gaga, she gets a lot out of that old Brandeis privacy doctrine because she says, this is my image. You have to pay money to use it. The rest of us get nothing out of it. And this is going to turn out to be the case. I guarantee you the right to oblivion, the only people who get benefit out of that are French politicians.
Sorry, I have to respond to this because there's a sloppiness in the kind of judge bashing and French bashing, this sort of vulgar anti-elitism, which is completely missing.
No, it's not vulgar. It's
completely
it's
missing. No, well, it's dreary, but it's imprecise because I never endorsed a broad right to oblivion. And in fact, I have grave First Amendment concerns against the right to oblivion.
Give it a rest, Jeff. I didn't say
Let me stress that I think that if we fail to act reasonably in protecting data privacy rights, then the Europeans are going to make it possible to remove images from Facebook, as an Argentinian judge has done, of a pop star who posed for racy pictures of herself and thought the better of it. And this will clash gravely with our First Amendment. I think we're about to see the biggest clash between privacy and free speech values in a generation. I'm on the side of free speech here, not privacy, so let's be precise about what we're saying. And that's why it's all the more important to prevent reckless government surveillance.
Mike Nelson with Georgetown University and CSC Leading Edge Forum. I'm glad you came back to the right to oblivion because it's a great example of policy made by bumper stickers, particularly dangerous when it sounds good in French. There's another European bumper sticker out there that actually worries me even more, which is silence of the chips. This is an idea circulating around some of the policy circles in Brussels and elsewhere that will actually require that sensors have some kind of device built into them that will allow us, the consumer, to turn them off and to physically see that the device is not on. So it's a way to build in privacy at the sensor level of this new Internet of Things that we're building. I'm concerned because it seems to me that that's the wrong layer to try to fix that problem. You have to take action at where the data is being collected, not at the sensor. And because it would probably raise the price of sensors from 5 cents to about $10. Do you have any answer to this question? I mean, when the Europeans get all upset about ubiquitous sensors and the fact that your sweater might be tracking you, what better solution do we have than the silence of the chips?
So I think the answer to most of the European data protection rules is, the bad news is they actually do believe this rights of man crap. The good news is they never enforce it, or they only enforce it against a few American companies. So, you know, this is a cross that we'll have to bear. But at the end of the day, they're not actually going to prevent the deployment of an Internet of Things because they can't. And they'll be a little they'll end up getting a few little concessions from technology companies by basically picking their shots and extorting fines from them for things that they've done. But they won't change the course of the technology.
I have to say I have a lot of respect for Stuart's, like the source of Stuart's anger, which is being locked in a room with European bureaucrats for like months at a time trying to extract like something like passenger records. So
they don't know how close to oblivion they were.
Yeah, exactly. I get where that comes from.
Well, I have a question in the back here.
Thanks, Wendy Seltzer, Yale Law School's Information Society Project. And it's a question for Stuart and Kashmir. Sorry to keep the focus on that end of the table. But you seem very concerned that we were likely to legislate for the gap when technology seemed new and scary, and then sort of be left behind when that technology was commonplace. And I'd suggest that that's precisely when we most need legislation, because we haven't yet gotten the feedback from technology about how our privacy might be implicated by it. So is there some way of enhancing the feedback so that we can see all of the ways that our information is being used and adjust more quickly to protect ourselves if we don't want ever more intrusive laws to give us that protection?
So you might try, if you're worried about, you know, how this will look in the future, you might try living in it and then make your decision about what kind of privacy standards you want to have. And that's, I think that privacy groups exploit that Luddite moment when we see the future and it isn't our present and we don't completely like it and we think maybe law will save us from the future. It won't. It'll just screw the future up in unintended ways.
Yeah, I think we see that right now with the dismantling of the Video Privacy Protection Act, where it was kind of knee-jerk passed in reaction to the Bork hearings, and now it's, you know, holding up Netflix, though not Hulu, in terms of deploying kind of new ways of sharing what you're watching. I think legislation should be, you know, held off until you really get a sense of how society is going to be using these technologies. That's it.
Well, just towards the end, let me just bring it back to poor Mr. Jones, who is waiting for the Supreme the justices to determine his fate. In many ways, I think the question is, if I can end on this, is you, we had talked a lot about, you know, difference in degree, difference in kind. We had talked about where do you draw the line, and I don't really hear a lot of people on this panel expressing a lot of confidence that the justices will be capable of really coming up with this really interesting theory about where that line gets drawn. I think there's a bit of consensus that we don't expect that to happen. That said, other people have mentioned during the course of this discussion that if there is a problem of defining where that line is, others will maybe perhaps swoop in and deal with it, whether it's Vivian Redding and Neelie Kroes in Europe, whether it's Ron Wyden in the United States Senate, whether, you know, it's the White House. What do we expect to have happen? Let's say that this thing, they don't really make any real substantive decision about where that line gets drawn, if at all. Whose court is it in? And I didn't really see even if you think there should be a court where that was that game is played, what happens after, if the court doesn't really do anything for, to define in any nuanced way where the line should be drawn? Let me go ahead.
So it seems to me that there are two clusters of problems that we should keep distinct here. So one is restraints on government, which is defined, you know, either through the Fourth Amendment or through statute. And the other is restraints on private companies, and that's really only a statutory question. There's no Fourth Amendment issue there, really, except maybe in the way that Jeff said, that there might be some way in which government access to third-party data is implicated. No surprise, I'm a big fan of the way the Obama administration is going about this problem, which is to say, rather than allow the Europeans to, by default, dominate the debate because the global ubiquity of the Internet means that our homegrown Internet services, by becoming global, become subject to European Data Protection Initiative, and therefore European standards effectively become American standards, I like the idea that we're trying to get the initiative. And one of the ways in which they've gone tried to seize the initiative is to go through this dual process where the FTC does its work, the Department of Commerce does its work, the White House has started to pull it all together and articulate a foundation for baseline legislation that I think, given the principles that I've seen, would do a pretty reasonable job of taking the best of the American traditions of privacy protection. I think actually, contrary to sort of the popular myth, especially in Europe, the U.S. approach has actually been a pretty good one, which is to say eclectic and diverse and event-driven, but nevertheless pretty well enforced when we do have principles, as opposed to the European one, which is highly broad, abstract, theoretical, and very poorly enforced in practice. Anyway, taking the best of the American tradition and applying it in a kind of a rational way to vindicate the basic principle of user choice, meaningful, knowledgeable, individual choice in the way that data gets collected and accessed. And I think I would just say one thing, which is that the approach very much takes as a starting point what Kashmir said earlier, which is that the gathering of data is no longer the big issue. Data is being gathered by telephone companies, by search engines, by cloud-based services, by the government. It's being gathered, and it's good that it be gathered. The real question is, when can it be used and for what? And there, I think, connecting those to principles based on user choice and consent in ways that are flexible for the digital age and the changes that we're likely to go through is the right approach. And so that's where I think the action is going to lie as the administration hands off to Congress a proposal for baseline privacy legislation. That's where I think it should lie. Meanwhile, I'd like to see the Fourth Amendment given real vitality in the Jones case by recognizing, as I said before, that differences can become, in degree can become differences in kind.
So Professor Rosen, quickly, then we'll go to Stuart, then end with Katra.
I'm cautiously optimistic that the court will offer some real guidance. I think it was great that all the justices except for Justice Alito seem troubled by this, and although they may not get consensus on a broad principle, I hope we'll have some vision forward. It's important because all the great advances for privacy in the past generations have come from guidance from the court followed by Congress stepping into the breach. That's what happened in wiretapping in the Berger case in the 1960s. The court sets a framework and then Congress responds. Again, I'm hopeful that there might be some bipartisan consensus on the Geolocational Privacy Act passing because of its sponsors. On the other hand, the trouble is that companies are recognizing that the line between government and corporate data gathering is going to be effaced in an age of cloud computing, and I fear, therefore, that the anti-regulatory lobby is going to resist even sensible restrictions on sharing with government in the geolocational arena in a way that would make the bill hard to pass.
So the court has a choice between a simple rule that they're not completely comfortable which is public is public, and with launching, you know, a awkward and unending campaign into hostile territory as they try to figure out where are we going to draw this line? Is it really a day, or what about 2 days? Maybe three. That's okay too. But a month. We said a month was no good. So when it gets to 3 weeks, we start to get, you know, it's going to be a nightmare, and that's just the beginning of the problems that they're going to have. Jeff probably hopes that the problems will get so bad Congress has to step in and write a rule. I suspect not. I suspect the court is going to end up, if they accept the invitation they seem inclined to do, of trying to write some rule. They will not do a good job. You can't write a clear rule out of the blue from the Supreme Court without being accused of judicial lawmaking. So then they're going to try to do it incrementally, and that's going to be a mess. So my prediction is that this will look a lot less attractive in conference than it looked at argument, and I kind of hope that at the end of the day they say, you know, maybe this would just be a quagmire, we won't do it.
I suspect that the court is probably going to follow the format from Kwan, the Supreme Court case over whether employers can look at your communications, your personal communications on your work devices, and basically kick it back to Congress and say, hey, this is a problem that isn't really adequately addressed. Can you do something about it? But I think as a society, the most important thing right now is public education and making people aware of the fact that, you know, their Facebook pictures can be used against them when they're doing job searches, and that their phone is a tracking device. I mean, I think Verizon is putting stickers on phones saying that this broadcasts your location. So I think the challenge right now is to get people to become aware of how much information they are broadcasting intentionally and unintentionally, and then allow them to make choices based on that knowledge.
So I really want to thank this panel. This has been a fascinating conversation, and thanks for the collegiality and the rigor and vigor with which it was discussed. So I want to, before I thank the panelists specifically, lunch is in the main ballroom with Congressman Goodlatte and Pandora founder Tim Westergren. Thanks to the panel for a great discussion.
Thanks.